Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
There's no indication that the virus will be more virulent than what we experienced in May and June.
And give Mayor Bloomberg credit, more than some other public officials, he is not hyping the swine flu threat.
But we must have, and we do have, contingency plans in case the virus becomes more widespread or more severe in its symptoms. In situations like this, it's natural to imagine the worst-case scenario, but all signs at this point in time do point to an outbreak that will be much more moderate.
And questions remain. When to close schools and who to vaccinate top the list. Glen Cove, Long Island, plans a no-touching policy, including no high fives or hugs this semester. And that was an interesting clip we just heard during the newscast, wasn't it? The city health commissioner saying that it's possible that people who've had swine flu, including possibly as many as 800,000 New Yorkers in the spring, are immune. So let's see what people are doing and search for the line between readiness and hype now with Erwin Redletter. He is the director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, where he is a professor. He's also a pediatrician and has been following the swine flu closely, locally and internationally. Professor Redletter, welcome back to WNYC. Good morning.
Thanks, Brian. Good morning to you.
First of all, on that immunity clip, I don't know if you heard it.
Yeah.
Do we assume that people who have had swine flu in this initial outbreak this year won't get it again?
Well, it certainly makes sense to assume that. The problem is we don't know exactly for sure. There may be some mutations that are unexpected. But generally speaking, if people have had H1N1 infection prior, then they ought to have some and maybe significant degree of immunity. It's just that we don't know for sure.
So when we prioritize who gets vaccinations, say if there's a vaccination shortage, which is a possibility, those people would be at the bottom of the list?
They might be. The question, what comes down to an individual patient. So if you can imagine yourself in a doctor's office, you say, I had a bad flu in May, although 95% of plus of those people probably had H1N1, we don't know for sure.
Because not many of them were actually tested.
Very, very few were tested. Less than 3% were tested. So we don't know for sure. So it presents a clinical problem, even though in the big picture, people are probably safe. If people are in a very high-risk situation in terms of their work, for instance, healthcare workers, and they say they had some sort of flu, we probably vaccinate them anyway. But that's going to really be dependent on a case-by-case basis.
Healthcare workers are near the top of the list for
correct.
Who should get vaccines when they become available, probably next month. Pregnant women top the list from the Centers for Disease Control, followed by healthcare workers, and then people caring for infants under 6 months old. Why pregnant women first?
Well, pregnant women, along with people with asthma or a history of asthma, and young people, seem to be the populations that are most susceptible to getting the virus, so that those people do get to the top of the list, and for the reasons that we don't really want to take any chances with those groups that are most vulnerable.
Is that different from the standard seasonal flu vaccine recommendations?
Yes, it is different. And we don't really know all of the reasons why these particular groups are susceptible, but actually we've seen this in pandemic flu epidemics in the past, including the very severe situation that we had in 1918, where young people and people presumably very healthy were getting and dying from the influenza of that generation at a much more aggressive rate than other parts of the population.
Dr. Erwin Redletter from Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health, my guest on WNYC as we talk about all these new swine flu preparedness announcements coming out from local governments and the federal government. We can take your questions for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You can post them to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. I have a pregnant friend who is conflicted about whether to follow this recommendation. She says this new vaccine will be basically untested for being developed so quickly. And, you know, she spent her whole pregnancy, like a lot of women do, trying to avoid exposing her fetus to foreign substances. Are there risks as well as benefits for pregnant women?
Well, there probably a risk for anybody. It's just a question of risk versus benefit and trying to decide between really only two courses of two possible options. Either you get it or you don't get the vaccine. And if you choose not to get the vaccine, it's like not vaccinating a child against mumps or measles, and that you take a chance that the child could get that illness and get very, very sick from it. Will there be a very small risk from taking the vaccine? Probably, but it's greatly, greatly outweighed by the risk of being exposed to actually getting H1N1. Which,
and again, I don't want to hype the risks as opposed to give the concerted effort that you're trying to make its due to warn pregnant women about the disease. But what would the risks be of the swine flu vaccine, if there are any? Is it possible to know?
Well, it's really very difficult to know. There have been some trials ongoing. There are no excessive risks as far as we know right now. It's just that when we start immunizing tens of millions of people, that we just don't know 100% for sure. But it's generally going to be a very safe vaccine. In 1976, when they had a swine flu outbreak, a much more limited one than we think that we're going to have, there were some cases of some neurological diseases that that people got, and still not 100% sure it was vaccine-related, but it is something that we'll be keeping an eye on. The problem gets down, Brian, just as you're saying, on individual case, does it make sense to provide a vaccine? In virtually all cases, it does.
I don't want to slough over that 1976 experience. Is that the year you said, or sometime in the 70s,
yeah, 76, right?
76,
yeah.
Where the swine flu vaccine actually turned out to be more lethal than the strain of flu, which never actually took off in the way that officials had feared.
Correct.
Why shouldn't we learn a cautionary lesson from that with respect to vaccination?
Well, because if we look at the sweep of history around pandemics, and we're not only looking at 76, but we're looking at 1918, we can see that the flu, this kind of pandemic flu, takes many different forms. It's just impossible to predict, either from the 1918 really outlandishly terrible pandemic with lots of lethality, or the 76, which turned out to be very mild type of pandemic. It's very hard to base a specific decision on whether to vaccinate or not. So in the overall picture, I think most public health officials are going to say very absolutely and clearly that getting the vaccine is less risky than not getting the vaccine. It's going to be that kind of grown-up decision that both doctors, public health officials will have to make on the one side and patients on the other side.
On a one-at-a-time, case-by-case basis.
Yeah, with general guidance that everyone should get it and then exceptions made as needed, but it's going to be, you know, it's going to be fraught with a little bit of uncertainty, and there's not much that can be done about that.
Andre in Hunts Point wants to know if he's one of those exceptions. Hi, Andre.
Hey, Brian, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I am HIV positive. Recently, as of maybe 2 months ago, diagnosed with cancer. Currently on chemotherapy, no longer on my HIV cocktail because of my chemotherapy, unfortunately. Should I be taking this vaccine? Because I know I'm not the only one out there who's in this scenario.
Well, first of all, I obviously cannot give you any kind of specific advice, Andre. I'm not your doc, and you have obviously a complicated situation. In general, people with chronic illnesses of any type should be taking this vaccine because you will also, unfortunately, would be more at risk from getting the pandemic. How old are you, by the way?
Andre, how old are you?
36 years old.
36.
Yeah, so You're still very close to a high-risk group in terms of being a younger person and in terms of getting the H1N1. So you really need to discuss this with your own personal physician. But as a general rule, somebody with chronic medical conditions who is in an age range where they're, you know, young and otherwise healthy should be getting the vaccine.
Andre, thank you. And another listener wants me to ask why people with HIV and AIDS are not, in general, near the top of the priorities list. He says they're never prioritized, and they're the most at risk. Is that Would you say either of those statements is true?
Well, I think people with HIV/AIDS, and first of all, the last time we had a major pandemic, and certainly the really severe pandemics of the early 20th century, we didn't have the kind of problem with HIV/AIDS that we currently are experiencing worldwide. And so there is an unknown factor here. But again, these folks with HIV/AIDS would have a chronic illness and should be prioritized. There's no question about that. All we know so far from the experience last spring is that pregnant women, people with asthma, current or past, and younger people are the risk categories. I'm not aware of a report, I could be wrong about this, but that showed that the HIV/AIDS patients were also more at risk for contracting H1N1, but I could be wrong about that.
Liz in Bronxville, you're on WNYC with Dr. Irwin Redlener. Hello.
Hi there. My question is it known at this point whether or not this new strain will net out to be any different or more threatening to our health than the standard flu strains we encounter each season? And if it isn't, why the heightened attention?
First of all, this is something that's very difficult for people to get used to. I'd say I have this question come up in my own with my own family, like very frequently, repeatedly. But the fact is, there is absolutely no way of knowing for sure whether it's just going to fizzle out and even be less severe than the typical seasonal flu, or somehow mutate into some form which is much more serious. We are dealing in a world of uncertainty right now about that. So all the hype that we're hearing, and we're really stepping on the line of not wanting to cause too much hype, but at least make people aware and have the proper preparation at hand. In other words, we don't know for sure the answer to your question, but as it's cautionary to say that we want to make sure that if it is turns out to be severe, that we've taken the proper steps, because it'll be too late once we find ourselves, let's say, November or December with a terrible pandemic and that we haven't made the preparation. Everyone hopes that it'll be mild, less severe than the seasonal flu. There's no question it's coming back, but there's no way to predict with certainty how severe it'll be.
Liz, thank you for your call. And Dr. Redlener, I have to say that some of these predictions from Washington, or maybe they're just inaccurate media representations of the predictions from Washington, you tell me, sound a little crazy to me. I mean, a planning scenario released by the White House assumes that half the U.S. population could get swine flu this year. Am I just too complacent, or can you put a number like that in some kind of context for us?
Yeah, I think they didn't say that it assumes that. I think it said that that is one of the possibilities, that we could get a scenario that is that severe. Although that report was countered very shortly thereafter by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, basically saying that we don't know anything about that kind of scenario in terms of it being on the table as a strong possibility. The point, Brian, is well taken that you're mentioning. Here's the problem. If we do get a very severe strain, there are lots of issues that we're really not prepared for in terms of the hospital's ability to get ready for a very substantial surge in inpatient admissions with very sick people. And we need to know about that as being one of the possibilities, so that really it's not really for the public so much as for our health and hospital systems to get that message, to get themselves geared up just in case. So it's a just-in-case scenario, and it should not be touted as anything considered to be the most likely by any stretch of the imagination.
And I'm glad you put it that way, because I think we have to parse the words, even in the way that I asked the question, which was taken from press reports, when they say that the White House, that it's a planning scenario released by the White House that assumes that half the U.S. population could get swine flu. So planning scenario means plan for the worst possible case, to be ready just in case.
Yes.
And that's the assumption, is that that could be the worst possible case. But then when the media gets hold of the word assumes and puts it next to assumes half the U.S. population could get swine flu, it leaves a certain impression out there that's much less nuanced than what you just said.
that's absolutely true, your analysis of that. And I'll tell you, one of the most difficult and challenging aspects of dealing with a pandemic is specifically along communications. What is the message for the public? What's the message for health departments? What's the message for hospitals? And all of those things are not necessarily the same message. And not only that, people hear the message differently. So communication, which is your business, and which I wish I had more of you developing those messages, that actually stymies a lot of health officials who really have difficulty parsing the nuances that are really so important to people. By the way, to that point, I should say that New York City has done a spectacularly good job of both developing plans and communicating those. In a meeting yesterday at Gracie Mansion, as you know, there was a very excellent presentation, and I think probably the most prepared city in the country right now is New York City and the surrounding area, which is good news for the Northeast.
I'm glad you mentioned the city and the city's plans. I want to actually contrast the statements of two city officials on this, which may wind up sending a mixed message if people hear both of them in the media, and they've both been on our air. Here is the New York City Schools Chancellor, Joel Klein, from that meeting yesterday, talking about closing schools only as a last resort.
We're going to have an open schools policy this fall, different from the policy we followed in the spring. We do not plan to close schools because they have flu activity. We're going to focus on preventive measures.
So there's the conservative approach,
right,
being planned in terms of closing schools. But this is from the Democratic mayoral debate last week between the hopefuls William Thompson and Tony Avella, a debate at which I was a questioner and which aired in full here on WNYC. And listen to what Councilman Avella said about his thoughts on closing schools.
I reached out to the mayor in writing immediately and the health commissioner saying, you can't just close one school because the kids from those schools have siblings who go to other schools. They play in local sports teams. Why don't we look at an area-wide strategy? There's no such thing as underestimating a situation like this. You'd rather go overboard and make sure that everybody is covered, make sure that the public and the students and the kids are safe. I don't think the city did enough, and we better damn well be prepared this year.
So you have the actual mayor saying close schools only as a last resort. You have a mayoral candidate saying you'd rather go overboard. What is the public supposed to make of this?
Yeah, that was certainly a confusing remark. I'll tell you that the city is planning intensively for a variety of contingencies, but I think the mayor and his team have been absolutely on the mark in this case because they have. It's not just that they're saying we're going to try to keep the schools open. They are saying here's what we are going to do, and it's a very positive program. That's I think is exactly right in terms of make sure that children and faculty of the schools get vaccinated. That they're monitoring very closely what's happening in the schools and in the hospitals, and that they're going to try to avoid interrupting the academic situation for children as much as possible. All of that, I must say, I fully agree with. And I don't think we should be doing anything more extreme than what the mayor just said.
We have a couple of minutes left with Dr. Erwin Redlener from the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, closely following the swine flu from a scientific perspective, from a public policy perspective as well. And I want to get Lannan Nyack in here because she's got an interesting question from her experience with the swine flu in the 70s. And Lynn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, hi. I've been listening to this very avidly because I had the experience in 1976 when President Ford made it was a very big fear-based epidemic at that time as well. I remember it quite well. And,
what happened to you?
Well, I lost my job because I was working. I wasn't a teacher, but I was working with an association where we would be working with children, and I was supposed to get the swine flu vaccination, and I just refused. I just had a very bad feeling about it, and I didn't have the greatest immune system, and I refused, and I lost my job because I wouldn't get the vaccination.
Then who was your employer?
It was someplace in California. So
was it a public system of any kind?
No, it was a private company.
Okay. So, Dr. Redlener, would anybody who works with children, since children are seen as particularly at risk for H1N1, be recommended to get the swine flu vaccine? Anyone who works with children as a group, in your opinion, and do you see that as enforceable in any way in the public or private sectors?
Well, I think that people that work with children should be getting vaccinated, and they will be high on the priority list for getting the vaccine. So, in my opinion, that is correct. In terms of enforceability, you know, this is going to be local decisions. I don't know how that could be enforced exactly. I don't think people should be losing their jobs over such a decision if somebody really does not want to get the flu vaccine. But, you know, it's if you want to be in proximity of groups of children on a continuous basis, then absolutely I think the safest thing would be to get the vaccine.
Before we run out of time, I do want to make sure to repeat, and we've had it on the news constantly for the last 24 hours or so, that the city is planning on making vaccines available for free at all public schools and private schools that are elementary schools. And I guess they're still figuring out how much to offer it at middle schools and high schools, but there are going to be free vaccinations at elementary schools, public and private, at least in New York City. Is there a historical precedent for that, as far as you know, Dr. Redlener, with respect to in-school massive vaccinations?
Yes, there have been in-school vaccinations in the past, but not in the recent past. And this is obviously a big logistic challenge for the schools and for the health system, but I think it makes a lot of sense. It's a place where all the kids obviously go, that all the families are familiar with in their communities, and so it is a wonderful place for making sure that we're maximally efficient at getting people who need to be vaccinated, getting them vaccinated. So that is, I think, it's a good strategy, and similar to our thinking about having school nurses in general, in that it's a place where the kids are, and we can do a lot of good by focusing on school-based.
What was the historical precedent? Was it polio?
No, I think it was smallpox, but I don't hold me to that. Yeah, right.
And I do see a mixed message coming out of different levels of government with respect to cutting schools. Mayor Bloomberg says as the last resort only, with more than a 4% infection rate in a particular school, and even not always then. But the Centers for Disease Control recommends it as a method of isolating the infected. So do you see the federal and city governments not on the same page?
I think they may not be on the same exact page with this particular point. And I think, again, you know, the closing of a school is very different now than it would have been, let's say, in 1918. And by the way, in 1918, cities that closed schools early and stopped large public events early seemed to have a better outcome in terms of the Spanish flu of 1918. But on the other hand, we had a time when then there was almost always somebody home, usually mom, and could take care of kids who were not going to school or not going to other events. Today, we have a situation where a huge number of families, the vast majority at this point, especially in New York City, may well have two working parents, so that we have questions about who will watch the kids if they do stay home when we close schools. What will be the effect on the economy if people have to stay home from work, especially if they really do need the income? It's a very difficult situation. And the other thing is that we found when schools were closed last spring, that a lot of the, let's say, middle school or high school kids would just congregate anyway and go to the mall, so why not be in school? So I think this is a much more well-thought-out strategy to try to keep the schools open as long as possible.
Erwin Redlener, director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. He's also a pediatrician and president of the Children's Health Fund. Thank you very much for coming on for this length of time and talking about swine flu with us today.
Anytime, Brian. Thank you.
And we will continue, of course, to follow this on The Brian Lehrer Show and on WNYC as a whole, as whatever outbreak occurs this fall. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and coming up in just a minute, candidates for Manhattan DA at a debate last night act like Well, prosecutors. Stay tuned for clips.